nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Let's get started. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you our PRISM seminar series speaker, Professor Ali Bescock from Old Dominion University. Professor Bescock got his undergraduate degree from Mid-Eastern Technical University in Ankara, and then he went on to receive a master and PhD degrees from Princeton University, and went on to a tenure track position at Texas A&M. More recently, he became endowed chair professor of computer engineering at Old Dominion University. He has joined Old Dominion in 2007. Not in the modest biography that Ali had put for the seminar announcement is the fact that he is very well known in the area. His PhD thesis was, without exaggeration, was pioneering work in microflows. He has published a very influential book on microflows. And the book is now in second edition. It's called Microflows and Nanoflows. So please welcome Professor Ali Bescock.
Thank you very much, I would like to thank Professor Alexanko for her kind invitation. And today's talk was originally scheduled for March 25th of 2011, but unfortunately, March 20th, our family was struck by the tragic loss of my brother-in-law. So I would like to dedicate this talk to Ken Rice. And Ken was a Purdue graduate, and he was the employee of Purdue University till his retirement in 2010. And he was a great guy, and he will always be missed by his family. So today's talk has the following outline. And first, I'm going to talk about Old Dominion University. Where are we and what we do? Old Dominion University resides in Norfolk, Virginia. And this is basically the Virginia Beach, and from here on is the Atlantic Ocean. It's basically a beautiful place surrounded by water, and here's the entry of the Chesapeake Bay. And it's a city of approximately 1.7 million people, but not only Norfolk, but this whole area. We call it Hampton Roads region. And basically, Old Dominion University is a major state-supported university in this metropolitan area that has 23,000 students. And indeed, we have beautiful waterfronts everywhere, including Virginia Beach. So having said that, a little bit about our college. Our college basically offers the PhD degree in all these topics, and there are about 110 tenured and tenure track faculty members, and approximately 2,600 total students, 600 of them being graduate students. It may not be very well known, but it may be also the only campus in the world that has a magnetically levitated train project that will be hopefully working. As you can see, there's a prototype of it is out there. So basically, it may not be very well known, but you know, it is out there and doing good work, in my opinion. So a little bit about my group. I'm Ali Bescock, and this is Professor Shizi Chan. And we basically work with a couple of postdocs and PhD students, and here's a group picture. And I'm the director of the biomicrofluidics laboratory over there, and the focus of the lab is to conduct fundamental and applied research in micro and nanoscale transport. And we apply these to biology using microfluidic platforms. We have quite a bit of an experimental work going on, as well as computational work that's listed over there. And today's talk is going to be covering the last three topics. First I have to tell you a little bit about what we do. So once I get there, I was able to establish a modest clean room facility. This is nothing compared to what you get up there, but still it enables us to do what we need to do. And in order to do experimental microfluidics, we have an inverted microscope with function generators and such, and we're basically able to do applied work with that. Very recently, we were able to purchase MultiView 4000 multiprobe AFM, ANSOM, and scanning probe microscopy system. The uniqueness of it is that it has four separate probes, and you can basically do four experiments at the same time. And these probes comes in different varieties. We can do temperature measurements. We can do thermally resisting the materials and the flows. We can also do electrical conductivity measurements. We have nanolithography capability, as well as, of course, typical AFM futures embedded in it. So this equipment allows us to do a wide variety of research at ODU between Dr. Chen and my group. So a couple of things that we have done in the past is that in microfluidics, creating pumps and pumping fluids is a key thing. So we basically use something like aluminum oxide membrane and use the pores of the aluminum oxide membrane to induce electroosmotic flow by basically depositing electrodes on the two sides of this material, and we were able to sustain and also theoretically explain the flow phenomena in this kind of a scale. An interesting extension of this is going to require atomic layer deposition in these nanopores, and hence we will be able to change the surface characteristics and vary the zeta potential and be able to get better performance from this membrane. Very recently, I graduated Dr. Sabunju, who has basically done this work. We are doing dielectric spectroscopy in a microfluidic system. It's very hard to see, but this is like a capacitor system in a microchannel, and you basically have fluid passing through it. And if you have cells in it, then you can actually measure their electrical properties, for example, permittivity, and you can see its variation as a function of frequency that's applied in here by changing the osmolarity of the buffer solution. That kind of a device basically enables us to make basic and quantitative biology research by changing the conditions of the fluid, and you can do it as a time-dependent phenomena too, and there are a lot of ways to expand onto this kind of ideas with experimental microfluidic systems. So one of the most major work that we do is based on AC electrokinetic phenomena. All these movies are basically looking into different colloidal particles, and we basically deposit electrodes onto the bottom glass, and say you put an O-ring and you put a colloidal fluid in between and you put a cover glass. By changing the applied AC electric field, you can see different phenomena happening with these colloidal particles. And in these movies, we have interdigitated electrodes, and indeed the dark gray parts are very thin gold layers. That's typically 20 nanometers in high, and this is the glass region you can see in between here. So what's really happening is that as you change the electric field, you can see different things. For example, in this movie, we're applying 2.5 volts, and we're cycling the frequency. As you cycle the frequency, you see different things. Totally Brownian, oscillating at about 100 hertz. And with 1 megahertz, we have chain formation, which we call positive dielectrophoresis. 10 hertz is that thing vibrating in the middle. So these are like basic motions of AC electrokinetics, which can be nicely characterized and be able to measured and theoretically verified as well. In this movie, we're separating 4 micron and 1 micron particles from each other, and the phenomena is purely dielectrophoresis. The large particles observing negative dielectrophoresis are pushed away, and hence they go towards the electrode middle, somewhere around here, where the smaller ones are chaining up with positive DEP. These kind of systems are extremely important in order to separate particles from each other in a microfluidic system based on their electrical properties. Our group has also worked on what we call an acoustophoresis, which is based on creation of a standing wave in a rigid channel. And indeed, when you have a particle flowing through here, if there's a standing wave, there's a direct radiation force that pushes the particles either to the nodes or to antinodes. And by that way, you can actually separate particles in a microfluidic system. In the movie, you're seeing basically everything is randomly flowing. When you turn on the certain frequency, particles start basically leaving from the middle of the channel. Something like that can be very important because here's basically the picture of it. What we wanted to do was we like to concentrate sporogenous bacterial spores from milk and apple juice, and we did this also in water, and you can see that characterization of the capture efficiency was great. Most of the bacterial spores were leaving, as can be shown here from the middle of the channel. So we are doing these kind of experimental work, and with the onset of this new AFM system, we got into some biomedical research. Apparently, there's a big problem of cartilage problems, and we believe that this cartilage problem is related with the physical properties of collagen fibers, which are nanoscale fibers. And we use AFM imaging to understand the topography, as you can see here, as well as we make force measurements to get physical properties like Young's modulus. In addition, we basically try to characterize typical size of these structures using this machinery, and we're hoping to do some more work on this. So that was basically a snapshot of what we were doing mainly experimentally, but we also have some numerical modeling going, and this one is typically looking into mixing in a channel. If you're familiar with the mixing problem, is that although the Reynolds numbers are extremely small, if you have species with low diffusivity, like macromolecules and so on, you're going to end up with problems of mixing it. So one way would be to induce chaos in the flow, and by using electroosmotic flow with zeta potential patterning, it is possible to basically get different flow patterns, and these are numerical simulations, all of them. These are particles and these are species based, and as you can see, for example, this case mixes red and blue streams pretty nicely, and you can see it down here too, compared to other one, which does extremely well right away, but then it creates these kind of regions where the particles cannot penetrate. So all of these things are, I think, important insights into the design of a microscale mixer. So the next slides shows our computational research. My background is on HP-type finite element methods, and you're looking into here a triangular element that's high order. And by using arbitrary Lagrangian Eulerian methodology, we can move this without remeshing in this kind of a case. And you will be able to do some physical things like look into the vortex shedding as well as mixing of two different fluids by this motion. And these are all based on solution of Navier-Stokes equations, or you can actually switch back and look into what could be done. Here's a dielectric interaction of two particles, and over here is the DC electrokinetic transport of a particle at a corner. Because of the applied electric field, the particle moves and turns around this corner and finds another orientation. This kind of research basically enables us to understand colloidal motion in microchannels. Having said all that, I guess that took about 15 minutes, but that's basically what we've been doing in general in the group. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about induced simulations of gas flows in nanochannels. I apologize that I had a surgery on my throat, and once I keep on talking, I still have difficulty. Sometimes I have coughing spells. So if you look into gas flow in micron or submicron scale domains, you realize that gas flows interact through intermolecular collisions, and you have basically domains that are with a characteristic length scale very small. And at one point, you can actually define a dimensionless parameter known as the Knudsen number as the ratio of mean free path to a characteristic length scale. And this basically becomes important once you are dealing with gas flows in small scales, or when you deal with extremely large mean free paths, which is rarefied gas dynamics. Now, of course, there's a lot of work done in the 60s on RGD, and then when the microflows, start to occur, it was mostly in gas flows at that point. Nowadays, it's always analytical chemistry on a chip. But when you have a gas flow in a small channel, you still have a finite Knudsen number. Importance of this is the following. If you look into variation of the Knudsen number, if you have, for example, very small values of Knudsen number corresponds to what we call the continuum flow regime, where you would use the Navier-Stokes equations with typically no slip boundary conditions. And with the increase of the Knudsen number up to 0.01 up to 0.1 puts you into the slip flow regime, where the rarefaction effects cannot be neglected and you still use Navier-Stokes. However, you utilize the slip boundary condition. And that's basically classically done by Maxwell's theory of slip and with Maxwell's slip boundary conditions. If you happen to go into a higher rarefaction regimes, then even the Navier-Stokes equations break down. So what do I mean by that? Is that the constitutive laws that define the stress tensor and the heat flux vector has to be reworked. And people end up with Burnett equations, which may or may not be converging at high Knudsen numbers. So indeed, because this kind of a derivation is based on perturbation expansion in Knudsen number, and Euler equation is assuming equilibrium, Navier-Stokes equations are going to be first order in Knudsen number, and the Burnett is going to be second order. So that kind of an expansion may not converge for very large Knudsen numbers. And if you deal with Burnett equations, you end up with higher order differential equations with even more complex boundary conditions, and it's really a research area, and sometimes it's basically neglected. Instead, people are using direct simulation Monte Carlo method. Another approach will be utilization of the Boltzmann equation, which is valid in the entire regime. However, intermolecular collisions create difficulties to get some solutions for it, and there are nice analytical solutions if you neglect the collisions. So all together, as you can see here, you have continuum slip regimes, and then the transition regime may be up to Knudsen 10, and from then on, one can assume free molecular. This is the classical picture that we give when we look into gas flows, even in small domains. But now, the question that we may like to ask is that you talk about a Knudsen number, and indeed, if you also have a Mach number, these together actually defines pretty much what's happening in the system, or it's Knudsen and Reynolds, is up your choice, it's according to you, you can choose it. The problem here is that are rarefied and nanoscale gas flows at a given Knudsen and say Mach number dynamically similar? That is the question that I would like to ask and hopefully be able to answer towards the end of my talk. And mainly, what's happening here is that they are, if you basically neglect what can happen by the Wall force field. So, but if there is a region where Wall force field effects are important, then maybe this similarity is not valid. As a matter of fact, this will only happen if the Wall force field is going to come up with a characteristic length scale of its own, which will create another dimensionless parameter in the domain, indeed. So, what in order to study this, we did something very simple. We're using a molecular dynamics method for simulating van der Waals interactions, and based on, of course, Leonard Jones potential that's given here. And over here, sigma is the molecular diameter. Epsilon shows the interaction parameter, actually, of the Leonard Jones, and which is basically shown here. So as if you fix one molecule and let another one come closer, then Lennard-Jones basically shows this kind. So this is basically an attractive and repulsive regime. And similarly, the derivative of this potential will give you the the force, which is shown by the dashed lines. Now, that being the picture, we're dealing with gases, and before getting into that, I guess just out of convenience, this is not 2 molecular, but at 3 molecular diameter away, we usually truncate the Lennard-Jones potential. 2 molecular diameters is too soon. But regardless of that, you have a molecule, this is gas flow, and you know that high Nusselt number means that there are less intermolecular collisions and more collisions with the domain. But even if you use the gas flow, you're going to have only few gas molecules. And here is a picture of an FCC structured wall. So the problem here is, of course, if you don't use a cutoff distance, you really have to calculate force interaction of all these wall molecules with this poor little, atom. And instead, what we do here is we created something called the smart wall model, and the essence of it is that interaction of this atom is happening with a patch of in the FCC structure with 1-0-0 plane facing the fluid. Only 74 wall molecules get involved on it, and then we use this stencil only, and using that stencil, whenever a molecule comes close to a wall, within an interaction force regime, the distance, this stencil just shows up, okay? So, of course, in reality, there are all these molecules out there, but we don't really have to simulate these because we are doing the cold wall assumption. That means that the molecules are not, the wall molecules' interaction with themselves are neglected, which is a approximation that people do all the time. And this is much different than, of course, dealing with the liquid case. Indeed, if you look into a Knudsen-Tam flow in a nanochannel, that's all you got as your molecules. So if you happen to go to a classical molecular dynamics simulation tool like LAMMPS, then you really have to create this and keep it all together. And it creates basically a computationally very difficult system. Because the gas flows interact through intermolecular collisions, we want to have at least one mean free path in the directions, in X and Y directions. Well, I guess like X and Z direction, we'll say Y is basically the height. So if you did that, look what happens to the number of wall molecules you need to carry versus number of gas molecules. Just to, simulate about a couple of thousand gas molecules, you have hundreds of thousands of wall molecules. But using smart wall molecular dynamics, you gain from the memory. That's the key thing, okay? So if those molecules happen to be showing up on the wall, that just appears and does its job. So the results I'm going to show you today is going to utilize the following setup. We're going to do a three-dimensional shear-driven flow that we call the Couette flow. And the objective of the investigation is to understand the wall force field effects in nanoscale confinements as a function of the Knudsen number and surface gas interaction strength ratio. And we are using Lennard-Jones potential, FCC wall with 1-0-0 plane faces the fluid. For simplicity, we assume that the wall molecules have same molecular mass and diameter and the potential strength as argon. But of course, you can actually change the epsilon parameter that you play with the strength of interactions. We use the smart wall algorithm to calculate surface gas interactions. And all the domains in the lateral and axial directions are on the order of mean free path. So that's the key thing. Simulations basically utilize Nozzle-Hoover thermostat to keep the system at MVT. That means the number of molecules and the simulation volume and the temperature are fixed the same. And we are basically sharing the two walls. So this is just a typical Couette flow case. I would like to show first the density profiles obtained at Nusselt number 10, and the interaction ratio of the gas molecules with the surfaces is kept as unity. And what you immediately see is that we did simulations at different channels. These are different channel heights, but we varied the pressure in order to have the Nusselt number fixed at 10. And these are the density variations. And indeed, if you normalize it with the bulk value, they are right on top of each other, so that change in the chain of the channel height does not really affect this distribution as expected. But as you can see, you reach to a density value in the middle, and then there's a spike in this density, and that spike is induced by the wall force field. Because of the wall happening there, gas molecules that is within a certain distance that we call actually wall force penetration depth will feel this, and then they're basically attracted and see this is a force minima. And I think I kind of like shift this as I was trying to rescale it, but that minima actually matches the density maximum as you would expect. So density increases in near wall region due to increased residence time of molecules, and normalized densities at different pressures are identical. Of course, this is something expected once you see this kind of a force field, and the other one is just an observation. Now, what happens if you change the entire molecular interaction between the gas and the surface? As you can see here in that snapshot, with epsilon ratio of unity, we had only few molecules at the wall, and each molecule is going to induce one smart wall pad, which is the same thing in your computer memory, and then you can see easily that this is easy, but look what happened there. So all the molecules are trying to get onto the surface. And indeed, when you reach to a steady state, and then you start to analyze this flow, you'll see that there's a big peak of number of molecules that's happening. And we calculated this. If it was totally absorbed onto the surface, there'll be about twice as many molecules as than the current case. So there's not a total case coverage of surfaces with argon molecules at this point. But density basically increases with increased epsilon ratio, and this basically becomes more and more dominant, as you can see with this kind of a scale. So the peak just moves on. What is perhaps more exciting here is that this is the moving wall. So we did simulations for different channel heights again at Nusen 10. And as you can see, there's a spike happening in the velocity as well. So it's not only a density issue, but it's also velocity peaks up in that kind of a regime. And because I have different channel heights, and I have normalized my y-axis, this is the channel half height, using the channel half height, you basically have spikes at different locations. If you looked into this picture in a way that, in a dimensional manner, because the wall force penetration of a Lennard-Jones potential is approximately 3 molecular diameters, which is approximately 1 nanometer for argon, you're seeing all the physics, or extra physics better to say, is happening due to in this regime that's about 1 nanometer away from the surface. So that's again the wall force penetration depth. An interesting thing that maybe you would like to observe is that we also put in this Boltzmann solution. So if you have a linearized Boltzmann solution at Nusen 10, and you will have different predictions of it at different momentum accommodation coefficients, say for unity versus 0.75. 0.75 is here, unity is there. In this scale, it's very hard to tell which one is better, perhaps. And I'm going to talk about that later, because it's a great importance for us as we are going to be determining what we call the tangential momentum accommodation coefficient. So if you happen to change the epsilon ratio, situation is quite different. Now, this is the unity. This is the one that I've shown you before. But when you look into epsilon ratio of 2, 3, or 4, you can see that this sublayer just, increases in velocity. And the good thing is it never exceeded wall velocity, as physically you would expect. But you can actually see that it's just going through there. Now, another thing you need to pay attention to here is that the length scale here is in nanometers. And in between 0 and 1, there are about 3 molecular diameters. That's about it, okay? So you cannot talk about exactly stick here, because this whole area is happening in such small regime that I cannot really claim that basically things are sticking and moving with the wall velocity exactly. And of course, the velocity goes to 0 because this is the center of the wall molecules, and the wall molecules have their own diameter. So for that reason, a lot of molecules cannot penetrate into exactly to the zero regime. If you look into this kind of picture by zooming in, this is what you will be observing. Obviously, with changing the epsilon ratio, velocity profiles are changing, and they reach almost a no-slip case, that's what I will call, for the high epsilon ratios. So, we are dealing with a flow system, and in this flow system, we keep the Mach numbers limited to, say, like 0.2 or so. We were very much interested in what happens to pressure, because obviously we're dealing with gas here, so we're keeping temperature a constant. Density of a MVT system is naturally a constant as a whole. There are density build-up, so what's happening to the pressure? In order to calculate the pressure, we use the Irwin-Kirkwood relationship, which has two components. This component is the kinetic part of it. That component is what we call the virial part, and the really virial part is related with the force interactions and the distances. So if you calculate these as a two separate phenomena effect, you basically have a kinetic distribution of pressure, the kinetic component. You add on it a virial component, you end up with the normal stress components. One observation is obviously the virial component goes to zero away from the wall. So basically, wall force field penetration effects being about 1 nanometer ends here, and effect of virial goes away. So this is induced by the surface. And as you can see also, that it is also anisotropic, because X and Z components of the virials are identical, while the Y component is differing because of the wall, and the interactions are happening mostly in that direction. So altogether, you have an anisotropic normal stress. You can only talk about pressure when those normal stresses are identical. And of course, that's happening outside the wall force field regime. And at that region, the kinetic theory part uniquely basically captures the ideal gas law by design. So because of that reason, yes, you can use, for example, ideal gas law, except very, very close to the surfaces, and then the notion of pressure basically has to be questioned because of the anisotropy induced. So if you can calculate pressure, you can also calculate the shear stress. So we did that for the quiet flow case, and you're looking into basically MD calculated shear stress, which is a constant, and right in the very, very next to the wall, it has a peak, and then it has to go to zero because the density goes to zero, because there are no gas molecules left over there, and there's that peak. And that peak is basically driven, again, by the virial term here, which is right here, and basically, the good news for all of us, DSMC people too, is that the shear stress definition that we use is pretty valid, except from right, like maybe like 1.5 molecular diameter away from the wall. So having said that, we basically did simulations for, constant velocities, so we kept the Mach number the same. We have different height channels. And of course, as the height of the channel changes, as the wall velocity is kept the same, the shear rate is going to get less, and as a result, you get less shear stress for higher Mach number. I mean, for higher channel heights. And however, if you did a simulation where you basically also increase the wall velocity so that the shear rate remains the same, you basically say all these three simulations give us identical shear stress distribution. And again, the wall force penetration depth is shown here. So this spike perhaps could be omitted, because we really have to discuss, where is the wall? Where does the wall start? I mean, how much can the gas penetrate onto the surface? So if you neglect that bit, you can actually see that you beautifully get the shear stress. Now, what we need to do here is utilize this notion in order to calculate an estimate for the momentum accommodation coefficient. So it turns out that if you use a free molecular flow theory, you have an estimate for the shear stress, which could be corrected for a finite Nusselt number, which is basically a curve fit that I did a while ago, as a function of Nusselt number. So if I say Nusselt 10, I can actually know tau over tau infinite, and tau infinite is already known. So by doing this, what we are doing here is, okay, with MD, we calculate this shear stress, and basically theory tells us is it has to be this. So the mismatch can be basically associated with the accommodation coefficient, which is alpha, tangential momentum accommodation coefficient. So if that is the case, this is of course basically telling, you know, looking at the two results, you're coming up with this value, and it turns out that if it is consistent, then the velocity profile has to be consistent. Otherwise, it can't be right. So basically, by finding the accommodation coefficient, we basically switch and look into the velocity profiles and look at them, that they match much better of the Nusantan case for R and D simulations for the value being 0.75 than unity. And these are all the values that we got for the simulations we made. So if you did similar simulations by varying the epsilon ratio, you end up with basically tangential momentum accommodation coefficient to increase and go to unity. So that means that with increased interaction strengths, we basically recover diffuse reflection from the surfaces, at least based on our methodology. So I would like to quickly show you what happens if you happen to have basically a Knudsen 1 flow. Now, for us, it's very difficult to go there because the channel height is now 1 mean free path. So this is a three-dimensional cubic domain. And as we change the epsilon ratios, you can actually see that, a lot of smart wall stencils on the wall means that there are a lot of molecules spending time on the wall. So indeed, the density shows a spike. The spike is tiny because the channel half height is about 27 nanometers. And here is a density spike that's basically similar to what you had seen earlier. Now, this is an interesting one. This is our velocity profiles. And of course, we calculate the accommodation coefficient using the shear stress, which I'm not going to show you to gain some time, but you can now clearly say that for this flow, for example, a Tamak value of 0.75 is far more superior to match it, at least with our model, than unity. And as you change the epsilon ratio, its value increases and you get closer to unity, but it's still 0.9. So these are the most recent results that we have obtained. And if you basically like to look into the velocity results, only linearized Boltzmann solution for accommodation coefficient of unity is shown here. But these are what you get as you zoom into this interest region. You're basically seeing velocity profiles. We really have to average our results a little bit longer to get a little bit better curvature here. But this is what we see. So I would like to basically conclude this portion of the talk. The wall force field penetration length emerges as an important length scale in nano-confined gas flows, in addition to the channel dimension and gas mean free path. So because channel dimension is a characteristic length scale and mean free path to that is the Knudsen number, but the force penetration length is an additional length scale, means that you can actually go like that length scale divided by channel dimension as another dimensionless parameter. So I think this is an important deviation that needs to be registered for nanoscale, nano-confined gas flows. And within the wall penetration region, we see important deviations in density, velocity, shear stress, and we have also seen that the pressure becomes anisotropic. So you can only talk about normal stresses, and these effects become more profound with increased epsilon ratio. We have also worked on a way to estimate the momentum accommodation coefficient, which increases and reaches to unity with increased epsilon ratio. And something that I haven't shown you in this talk is that we have also shown that for a fixed epsilon, the accommodation coefficient is independent of the Knudsen number. So these are all the results from these three publications, and fourth one is going to be submitted fairly soon. And these are all based on the dissertation work of Murat Barışık, who will be hopefully graduating this May. This basically puts me in a tough situation. And I just want to tell you a little bit about some other work that we do. So, and that's basically molecular dynamic simulations of interface thermal resistance. So that's going to be done for liquid and solid interfaces. And it's well known that thermal transport through an interface between two dissimilar materials result in a temperature jump, which is due to what we call Kapitsa resistance. That means that if there is a heat flux through the interface, this is going to be times the Kapitsa resistance determines the temperature jump. Of course, that kind of enables us, or in order to use this, you first of all have to know whether, how to calculate the heat flux and whether quantum approach or atomistic approaches are more important. These are things to be discussed. Real quickly, our model is now more familiar. It's basically liquid flows. But what we did here is that we try to keep one wall at a given temperature, like a low temperature, and the bottom one, say, at high temperature. So we can induce heat flux in this liquid system. And we can calculate heat flux and see whether Fourier law is valid. I'm not going to show it, but it indeed is valid. Even this is about 3.4 nanometer channel. So here is the deal, though. In order to run such a simulation, you need to have a thermal wall model. We developed this interactive thermal wall model, which assumes that the wall atoms are attached to the center of an FCC crystal structure, and they can basically vibrate with some springs, with a given spring constant. And each wall layer is kept at a constant temperature, so I can have an isothermal surface. So I'm literally assuming that the thermal conductivity of a solid is much, much larger than the liquid. So, and also I'm only having three or four layers of solid, so I'm not really interested what the temperature distribution is doing on the solid. I want to keep it at isothermal conditions. If I can do that and then be able to induce a temperature gradient, provided that you can first define a temperature and hence take its gradient, if you extrapolated that to the wall and through the extrapolation between that value and the wall temperature gives you the temperature jump and it also gives you what we call the Kapitsa length. So, as you can see that the previous formula is here carried up, but this is also now characterized as a function of the Kapitsa length times the thermal gradient from the liquid side. So our challenge from now on is trying to figure out how Lk value varies. So without getting into details because of lack of time, there are some theories based on that, like acoustic mismatch or diffuse mismatch models. And there are recent MD studies that claim that this is a function of surface wettability. So first, surface wettability is basically this epsilon ratio that I showed you for the gases. So what we have hypothesized is that perhaps in a dimensionless manner, well, this is not dimensionless and neither is that. So I take it back. Perhaps the temperature jump is a function of the thermal oscillation frequency ratio between solid and liquid that relates itself to this stiffness of the spring, kappa, okay? And the epsilon ratio, which is the interaction strength between fluid-fluid and fluid-solid, and the wall temperature. If you assume that could be the case, then perhaps we can find a phenomenological model for Lk and be able to use this as a Navier-type boundary condition. In order to go forward with this, we did sets of simulations at different temperatures. And what you see here is the temperature jump as a function of the stiffness. And the stiffness ratio relates itself to the wall fluid vibration frequencies in this manner. So what we observed here is indeed Lk, which is the Kapitsa length, varies as a function of kappa ratio almost quadratically. So that's basically why we wrote it that way. So it's just a functional variation. There's not a coefficient, so it's a proportional. So it varies with this proportionality. Similarly, we have done variations of the epsilon ratio. And we have seen that the thermal resistance length versus epsilon decays. That decay is especially logarithmic, and we curve it to that variation. Okay? So you have those two things in hand. Then basically, here's my exponential variation, decay with the epsilon ratio. And here is a functional dependence of the kappa squared, which is omega ratio to the fourth. Then we realize that there is still a variation as a function of wall temperature. So by doing a lot of simulations at different wall temperatures, enabled us to, just write this alpha of T wall as a nice little linear variation. And then we basically got ourselves a general formula that can actually utilize a thermal gradient and associate it with it with the temperature jump. And of course, this is basically using some properties of the material and the properties of wall gas liquid interaction parameters. So this is a phenomenological model that has been trained by using epsilon ratio of unity versus, at epsilon ratio unity at different kappa values. And then we kept kappa, say, arbitrarily at 3, and we increased epsilon ratio. So we trained this model, and we now have a Navier type boundary condition, which we can have an analytical solution for a heat conduction problem. And we are going to now compare in this map, in these locations, these are different kappa and epsilon values, the predictions of the molecular simulations with the continuum equation given up here based on our new boundary condition. Indeed, it matches extremely, extremely well. So basically, you can easily see that in a small channel, at least with argon, the continuum behavior sets in, and you can recover Fourier's law, and you will be able to actually use this boundary condition LK, which was in the previous page, be able to, handle it with continuum methods. So, real quickly, what would happen if there is a shear-driven flow? Then you also end up with having viscous heating, and by keeping the temperature of the walls at different temperatures, both say 100 Kelvin, with this interactive thermal wall model, we can dissipate that heat through heat transfer to the walls. Indeed, when you do this simulation, these are the velocity profiles you get. Like with strong interaction, you have a stick effect, and with lower interaction with liquids, you will have a slip effects and so on. But more interesting here, because this was already shown, what happens to a temperature profile? This is a strong wetting, and this is a very difficult-looking profile. But this fellow here, with the weak wetting, which means small epsilon ratio, is parabolic temperature distribution, which makes you wonder, of course, there's a large temperature jump, whether we can actually use our formula that we have and be able to get this. And I'm going to just basically jump to the results here. If you were solving an energy equation, you have to know the variation of the shear rate and the viscosity and thermal conductivity and density of the fluid. Turns out that approximately these things reach to a constant if you use bin sizes that are on the order of molecular diameter. And you will be able to get an analytical result, which is shown here with these red lines, that match with the MD results shown by the dots using our LK model that I have presented earlier. So I would like to basically conclude that we have developed a phenomenological model for the Kapitsa length as a function of surface wettability, thermal oscillation frequency, and surface temperature. We have seen that the temperature jump decreased with increased wall vibration frequency, and it increased with the epsilon ratio. And this model, combined with the Navier-type boundary condition, enables prediction of temperature distribution in nanochannels using continuum approximation, both for heat conduction and viscous heating cases. And these are the three publications we have done. This work was by Bohun Kim, who is now an assistant professor at the University of Ulsan in Korea. So basically, I would like to end my talk by acknowledging support that we have received with various agencies, including the Batten Foundation that supports my endowed chair and NSF grants. So thank you very much.
Are you able to use the smart wall boundary condition in the thermal transport problem?
For thermal transport, we need to have the wall molecules to vibrate. And once they are vibrating, how they vibrate is extremely important. So the short answer is no, because that you create a history effect. You cannot always start the boundary conditions with the same thing. I mean, once a molecule comes and interacts with it, it's already vibrating. Those vibrations are going to be changing if you implemented it. So this is basically a current bottleneck, because I really wanted to go and do gas flows with thermal interactions, but yet we are not able to do that. That's a very good question indeed. Yes?
So I noticed in a lot of your work you have the ratio of the Leonard-Jones energy parameters. It would be really useful if you could put that in terms of a hamburger constant relation, like the Kapitsa resistance. I was wondering if you tried that, or is it not viable?
Can you say it again? Put it in what form?
In the Hamburger constant.
Hamburger constant. I see. We haven't done it that way, and this is all obviously published work, but we may, if we pick it up, we'll do it that way.
Yeah. If you can do it, I think it would be really useful.
I see. Yeah.
What is the limitation? Like, what is the highest temperature this theory can be applied?
With temperature jumps?
Yeah, if you have two FCC surfaces and one of them you start to heat up and up, and what is the limitation?
Good question. Well, I didn't think about that, really. So I don't know the answer. This is something for us to really seek. I mean, we have done things like we tried even gas flows around the room temperature, which worked okay. You know, we haven't really taken up higher than that. Yeah.
I have another question about the Leonard-Jones potential. So, say if we don't simulate a system, not organ, in a real application, is there a way to calibrate the constant in that potential?
Well, as far as I know, when people use lamps, for example, they use an approximation by knowing interaction that's happening with, Leonard-Jones parameters of fluid-fluid versus solid-solid. They use those two values to predict a combined value when it happens to solid-fluid. For example, when you have an argon-silver system, that epsilon ratio is about 6. So, you know, that's typically how it's done. All right.
One more question. If you introduce some even small roughness deviation from FCC, which is, so what you would expect, just some linear change with roughness, or you will have completely different story because you have like seeding for attraction and so on?
Well, there are recent papers by Prezhnev's group in Michigan Tech, I think, who tried to do these kind of simulations. We haven't tried it, but even that roughness is still going to be an atomistic scale roughness, right? So it's not going to be a realistic roughness in many sense. And what would happen, again, is hard to predict. And I wouldn't like to bet my money on anything on that. So you're not asking the questions that I know the answers of, you see. Right. So
let's thank Professor Prashkap again.
Thank you.